And Vice President of the Berkeley Fellowship, I'd like to welcome you all to the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists this evening. We would like to dedicate this program to the memory of Troy Anthony Davis and also to the 9 passengers killed last year on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, to Vittorio Arrigoni, and to the countless other innocent civilians, prisoners, activists, artists, and journalists who have been victims of discrimination, war, or efforts to uphold human rights and the freedom of the press. One of the reasons I joined the Berkeley Fellowship way back in the early 90s was the activism of many of its members. Two people in particular, sequoias of this fellowship, Hal Carlstad and Paul Sawyer, were very adamantly against the death penalty. They were outside of San Quentin every time there was an execution. That, many other reasons, is why I'm standing here today. I would like to say that we are all Troy Davis and the death penalty now. You know we are here for you at your events. Our Social Justice Committee meets the first and third Sundays, and all are welcome. I want to thank the goddess of the KPFA, Dennis, Amy, Bonnie, Chris, and whoever else you listen to. I do miss Amy.
Andrew.
Kevin. Two more things I'd like to say. If you have been paying attention to the past few weeks about 9/11, I have not heard one word as to why. When I saw this on television, September 11th, 10 years ago, and the second plane hit after the first one, I said, why? Why? Why would they do this? I read in the Chronicle, in a little article, like two or three days later, there was a quote that Osama bin Laden was behind this, and one of the reasons, one was to get the U.S. bases out of Saudi Arabia. Am I right on that?
Yes.
The other one was for a resolution of the Palestinian question. Do you remember that too?
We're going to get to it again.
What was the third one? Anybody remember? Anyway, in that vein, if any of you can make it to Mocha for Mecca. Saturday, September 24th, 1 to 3, and that's 38 9th Street.
Tomorrow, 3 o'clock, there's a protest tomorrow.
There's a protest tomorrow, 2 to 3, right. You can help. Now, one more thing about that. Try to be there. We had a Board of Trustees meeting here on Tuesday past. I brought up the idea of asking Barbara if she would like to have some of her paintings of the kids' works displayed here. The board was in favor of it. I have to get in touch with Barbara, but there would be at least some visibility and let the fascist community know that we're standing up for justice and for children. Now, I have KPFA has supported us. I have a prize that Andrew was at our fundraiser a couple of weeks ago. He won a door prize. I have it here for him. I will show it to you, and then I will turn this over to Janet.
Well, hi, everyone, and thank you for coming tonight. We've had some...
We need the microphone.
That one's good, too.
Take this over to me.
That's for Andrew, when he gets here.
There have been some issues tonight. Some things got lost and whatever. I don't want to go into detail, so please forgive some of the disorganization. My name is Janet Cobran, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to combine two issues that I am most passionate about, Palestine Solidarity and KPFA Pacifica Advocacy. And I am Troy Davis. Tonight's event is a benefit for KPFA 94.1 and the RAID Film Project. The program is chock full, so I want to get underway. First, I want to thank everyone who has helped make this happen, BFUU for hosting, BFUU Social Justice Committee and staff, and especially David Yandel, who is in the back helping us with technical issues. Also, Cynthia Johnson, who has been the chair of the Social Justice Committee here and is also a KPFA local station board member. She can't be here tonight because she is observing the Pacifica National Board meeting that's meeting in Washington, D.C. this weekend. I want to thank the KPFA staff who helped publicize the event, especially Sabrina Jacobs, and the Coalition for Democratic Pacifica, and all the other volunteers helping tonight. And last but not least, my colleague Masood Nayori, who designed the flyers and posters. The program covers a number of related issue areas. We will learn about some of the challenges facing journalists who cover actions and other events, especially when there are sides, and when they might personally sympathize with or support one of the sides. We will explore the line between journalism and activism in actions such as the Gaza Boat Projects and flotillas, starting with presentations by myself, Henry Knorr, and Kathy Sheets. And then we'll hear from Kevin Pina and Dennis Bernstein. Last year's flotilla has come into the forefront again with the recent Palmer Uribe UN report, one that was political, having been tasked with smoothing out Israeli and Turkish relations since Israel's raid on the flotilla. The report countered some of the previous UN investigations and conclusions, and the effort apparently backfired given Turkey's response. But speaking of the raid, we will preview a film called The Raid, with never-before-seen eyewitness footage that counters the narrative and doctored videos created by Israel to frame the spin that was injected into the media immediately following the raid on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla last year. We will then hear from the filmmaker via Skype. This is also a book party, and I will talk a little bit about a book written by another journalist who was on the flotilla last year, and the books are over there, and you can purchase them. And we'll end with Q&A. So, let me, one moment. Okay, so about the line between journalism and activism. I began working on the Free Gaza Movement Boat Project in the spring of 2008. All aspects of the actions were understood to be legal. There were four additional successful FGM boat trips after that, and several others that failed after Operation Cast Lead began. The flotilla movement grew out of these efforts. All of these boat actions were organized primarily by activists, but there was always a media consciousness, and developing a media strategy was an integral part of the planning. After all, as I believe it was Gandhi who said, nonviolence needs an audience. The FGM knew that media visibility of the boat trips was key, not only to educate and expose the public to the issue at hand, but to have a form of protection. If one takes an action and no one knows about it, it is not likely to have any impact. If anyone doing the action is harmed, they may not have the support they need. This has become standard in most organizers' toolkit. The project organizers want exposure in media outlets, especially the mainstream, before, during, and after an action. How do we do that? How to get journalists to cover the story and outlets to report on it? What is tricky about these various boat actions is that journalists were invited on board to witness, document, interview organizers and participants, and make reports. This included filming and documenting cargo, if any. Were these journalists part of the action, or were they observers? The organizers also want to publicize their action with their own tools, website, press releases, press conferences, to explain in their words what they were about, without someone from the media interpreting for the audience. One might categorize this as creating propaganda to support their action. Then you also had activist participants who were doing their own interviewing, documenting, and filming during the action, and posting reports and videos on their own and other websites. What category does this fit into? Activism or journalism? And finally, what I ended up doing during the last flotilla action last summer, this past summer, was being part of the land crew of the U.S. boat to Gaza in Athens, attending and participating in meetings, being with passengers and organizers, helping in any way I could. Yet I had also arranged with KPFA before I left for Athens to set Kevin Pina up with people there to interview in order for him to give updates on flashpoints while Dennis was on vacation. I ended up wondering if I was operating as an activist or a media person myself. I leave you with these questions that I expect other speakers will touch on. So let me now introduce Henry and Kathy. So, Henry Noor. Former San Francisco Chronicle columnist. He has volunteered with the International Solidarity Movement in various parts of Palestine. He was the Bay Area media lead during the 2010 Freedom Flotilla and a passenger on the U.S. boat to Gaza, the Audacity of Hope, one of the boats in this summer's Freedom Flotilla. And of course, Henry is a member of KPFA's local station board.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out. Let's see, I guess I wanted to start by reporting a couple of pieces of news. First, I want to follow up on what Gene was saying about the MoCA, the Museum of Children's Art in Oakland. I think probably everybody knows the story about they we're scheduled to have an exhibit of children's art from Gaza, and the board overruled the staff and abruptly canceled it 10 days ago or so. And in case you didn't get the details, there's a demonstration tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. It's only an hour long. I know it's work time for a lot of people, but if you are free, please do turn out. I think it's very important that we stand up to the bullies who are behind us. That relates to some things I'm going to say in a minute about the media, but it's at 538 9th Street in downtown Oakland. It's just a few couple blocks from, three blocks, I guess, from 12th Street. The 12th Street Bar, if you're traveling that way, it's between Washington and Clay, so not very far out of downtown. And the program is only going to be an hour. There'll be some Friday speakers. And one interesting thing about it is that a lot of people from the Arab American and Muslim communities are participating in the program and are going to be turning out, so, as well as, you know, a wide variety of other people. So, and then Saturday there's going to be a grand opening of the exhibit. It's going to be pretty much exactly or close to the program that Mecca had originally planned. The only difference is instead of being inside the museum, it's going to be outside, on the street in front. It's going to be a family-friendly event. I'm hoping a lot of people, kids, families will come. There'll be music and poetry and food and so on. That one's not going to have a political flavor, but it's very important that people turn out. So I hope you can make both of those events, and if not both, then one. The other thing I just want to report, a piece of good news that I think even Flash Points at KPFA News missed tonight. But I attended today a hearing in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco. And for once, our court system was great. This is a suit that I didn't know much about. Apparently some Zionist organization had sued the University of California and the chancellor and the president and various other officials, as well as the associated students, complaining that by allowing the Students for Justice in Palestine to put on Apartheid Week, the annual series of demonstrations, I guess it's in March, I think, that was creating a climate that limited the freedom of the Jewish students, or at least a few of the Jewish students, to exercise their freedom of religion or something. The plaintiffs, as well as lawyers, separate lawyers for the university on one hand and the ASUC on the other hand, submitted their briefs. And this hearing was for the judge to discuss with them his preliminary take on the thing. And he just shredded the suit just completely. It was really, I hardly ever felt myself in a courtroom going to the judge, it was only, he didn't give a final ruling. He said he was just running his tentative, what his reading of it was in preparation. He wanted to hear their responses, and then he'll issue a ruling. But anyway, it was very heartening. So there's some, the other guys have a lot of power, but there's some restraints on them still. Let's see. Okay, on to the business at hand. About the media, I think it's no secret probably to people here that the issue of Palestine, Israel-Palestine, is really like no other as a taboo for the American media. People probably know my story. I don't want to go into great length, but at the time it was said that I was fired for, from the San Francisco Chronicle, in case people don't know, in 2003. The story was that, and the immediate occasion was that I was fired for because I took a day off the day the shock and awe thing happened to participate in the demonstrations in downtown San Francisco, and I got arrested and so on. That was the occasion for my firing. The bad story was that I really got on the boot list the summer before, 6 or 8 months before, when I went to Palestine and joined with the International Solidarity Movement. I went on vacation. I didn't go as a journalist. I went entirely as an activist. I didn't take a press pass. I barely had a notebook. until then, I had been a golden boy at the Chronicle because I wrote about tech, and tech was big in those days, seemed very lucrative, and my column was popular, and the bosses loved me. They kept giving me raises, and some other employers tried to poach me, and they, you know, gave me all these counter offers, and so on, so on, so on. But all of a sudden, when I went to Palestine, everything changed. I gave a seminar at lunch, an entirely voluntary. I showed my slides and talked about what I'd seen and heard in Gaza and some of what I felt about it. And apparently, some people, it was 25 or 30 people, attended. And afterwards, the boss's secretary, she had reserved the room, a conference room for me. She said to me, "Boy, I sure made a mistake. I shouldn't have done that." Because some people apparently complained that I had made anti-Semitic remarks and so on. Then I wrote one column about Israel, because of my, the nature of my beat, it wasn't an easy fit. I had actually tried to write for, volunteered in fact, for free to write a feature or two about my experiences in Gaza for other sections of the paper. No one would touch it. So I had to try to find some way to relate it to my beat, which was about technology. I finally ended up writing a column about the Intel factory in Israel and the history of the land that it's on. And what happened then, the day it appeared, the Jewish Community Relations Council of San Francisco and the Israeli consul stormed into the Chronicle building and demanded a meeting with the publisher and, you know, claimed they had lied about this and that, which of course they couldn't have. It wasn't syllable, the thing was inaccurate. But from then on, I was in trouble. And I think they couldn't really fire me at the time because, in fact, not only was it completely accurate, but I had turned the thing in a week. I turned it in early. I warned my editors that it was controversial. My editors in the business section were a little naive. but they had, so they really didn't have any case for firing me. But from then on, I knew I was in trouble, and then when I took that day off with advance notice to my editors, when the war in Iraq started, that was it. Just an observation or two about the how these things work. From my sense, there are a few people, certainly at the Chronicle, and I think it's true at most places. There are some media people who are Zionists who see themselves as watchdogs, you know, who are determined to prevent anything critical of Israel appearing in print if they can, or in whatever broadcast. But I don't. That's not really the heart of the problem. Although they're nasty, but the real heart of the problem is the other people who are just want to stay out of trouble, because the Zionists have, you know, created a climate where. You know, a journalist knows that if you put something in the paper or on the air that's going to provoke the Zionist, then you're going to cause trouble for yourself. So most of the people I found at the Chronicle, you know, on the whole, they're liberal, not all of them, but there were some who were ardent Zionists, both Jews and non-Jews, but the real problem was the people who were just afraid that they just didn't want to bother, you know, like it's not worth it to them. They don't have any particular commitment to truth or justice when putting something in or shaping a headline or whatever is going to get them in trouble. So, you know, I don't know what we can do about that except really it has, the only way to change that is to change the overall political climate around this issue in the country. You know, we're not going to be able to stop the Zionists from making a ruckus, but we need to make it clear to the people in the media that there is a counterforce of people who really wanted to tell the truth about this issue and really aren't happy with the way they've covered it. So I had a bunch of things I was hoping to say about the flotilla experience and the media on the flotilla, which I think was very interesting, but I'll have to say when time's up, so maybe Kathy will take it up, or we can deal with it in the Q&A part later on. Thanks.
So next, we're going to have Kathy Sheets. We have a little technical thing we have to take care of before she starts, but let me introduce her. Kathy is a registered nurse with a master's degree in sustainable development, specializing in food security. She has worked on human rights, health, and food security, most often in Haiti. She was drawn to the struggle of Palestinians and was on the first successful Free Gaza Movement voyage in 2008. She was also part of the two later attempts to enter Gaza by sea, June 2009 and last year's flotilla. And she was the nurse on the U.S. boat to Gaza this past summer. So bear with us for a moment.
I'm wondering, Hannah, you were pointing to some very important information. I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking while we set this up. You were speaking about the interesting part of the media.
Just about the flotilla, sometimes people ask, you know, was it a failure? Are you disappointed or whatever? I'm talking about this year's flotilla. And of course, in a certain sense, it was. We were thwarted by the Israelis. We got about 2 miles outside of the harbor of Piraeus and then stopped because they succeeded in outsourcing the blockade of Gaza to the Greek Coast Guard in this case. And of the 10 or so ships that were planning to participate in the flotilla, only one of them, which had set out from France and managed to get anywhere close to Gaza to confront the Israeli forces. The rest of us were two of the boats were sabotaged and the rest were bottled up by the Greek and Turkish governments. But some of you have heard me give this spiel before, so I'll keep it quick. To me, I never thought we were going to get to Gaza. Apparently some of the people on the boat did for reasons I can't really fathom, because to me it was completely clear after what happened in 2010 and everything we heard from the Israelis afterwards, defending and justifying what they did in 2010, promising more of the same this year. I don't know if you all were following it, probably not as closely as I was, but all through the year, the different Israeli officials, from Netanyahu on down, the various generals were talking about their preparations for the next flotilla. You know, 1 week, some general would say, well, we're going to use the attack dogs next time. And 2 weeks later, some other general would say, oh, we're getting our snipers ready. And mobilizing the Navy and calling up the reserves and this, that, and the other. And of course, talking about how it was such a terrible threat, all these activists represented such a terrible threat, existential threat to the life of the Jews, and the latest, second only to Ahmadinejad as a threat. So I didn't think they were going to let us through. So to me, I always thought of the thing as a media spot, to put it bluntly. Janet said the demonstration is always media dependent. It's particularly true when you think it's going to happen in the middle of the ocean. Sometimes a demonstration, at least there's some part of the ruling class or something that there, maybe you think they'll see you and see your power or something. In this case, if it had gone as planned, no one would have seen it except the Israeli Navy and our people and the media. Now, in fact, of course, we did get stopped sooner than we thought, and in a different way. We didn't get to confront the Israelis. But we have a ton of media, and it's in that sense, I think we took advantage of an opportunity. The opportunity was really created by the blood of the Turks, who were killed in 2010, absolutely. I can just tell you a little bit from my own experience. As Janet said, I was doing the media liaison, whatever, PR person for the flotilla in 2010. I put out press releases to hundreds of reporters, a whole bunch of them, in the lead up to that, and I didn't get a nibble from anybody, or maybe a couple, but basically no interest whatsoever until the Israelis attacked. People got killed, and then for days afterwards, both of my cell phone, my regular phone, everything was ringing off the hook constantly. This blood, they want it. And created an opportunity this year, because when we put out our, you know, contacted the press in various ways in advance of this one, you know, all of a sudden they were interested. And, you know, they didn't admit, and perhaps weren't even conscious of the fact that it was because of people having died the year before, but clearly, you know, that was the difference. But we all took advantage very systematically. The group on U.S. boat, there were 36 passengers and a good land crew, and we worked very hard to exploit that opportunity. I did, I think 12 or 13 interviews before I left, some of them with, you know, small various KTFA shows and other, you know, real modest online things and so on, but several with me, you know, on KGO and two of the main, I don't even remember the initials, but two of the main network TV stations in San Francisco actually sent film crews to my house to film me in advance. I'm just giving my own case as an example, but other people are doing similar things. And, you know, they were basically interested. I cracked up at one point during one of these interviews, because I couldn't believe how many ways the reporter was trying to ask, "Aren't you scared?" That's what it came down to. You know, kept sort of, you know, phrasing it differently, but that was the thing they kept hammering on. But I had kind of thought it through in advance, and so my answer was, yes, of course I'm scared, but I feel it necessary to go on this thing anyway, and here's why. And then I went on to talk about Gaza and the conditions in Gaza, and my experience there in 2002, and other things that I know about it since then, and try to focus the thing not on on us and the activists, but on the people of Palestine. And just as an example, one of these TV crews, they wanted some, they said, you know, got any pictures of yourself in Gaza? I didn't have any pictures of myself. But I had dug up, you know, deep in the, I was there in 2002. I've been back to Palestine a number of times since then, but I couldn't get back to Gaza. I dug up from the bowels of my computer some of the old pictures I had taken in 2002, relatively low res. But I pulled them up on my computer screen, and the guy, you ready to go? I'll finish up. I brought these pictures of the destruction in Rafah and Khan Yunis, in particular the southern part of the Gaza Strip, in 2002. You know, not a tenth as bad as it is now, but it was already horrifying then. You know, seeing it was just a wrenching experience for me. And anyway, I pulled up these pictures, and the guy, you know, had his camera over my shoulder, and he filmed my computer screen, and lo and behold, on the 11 o'clock news that night, they did a little number with excerpts from the interview with me, and they showed every single one of these half a dozen or so pictures I had. You know, it didn't change anything for the people in Gaza, concretely. The facts on the ground, you know, the reality of their life didn't change. But actually, how often do people in the UN, in the Bay Area even, get to see what Gaza actually looks like on the 11 o'clock news? So that in itself to me, and then to top that all off, the next day my mailman came by and said, "I saw you on TV last night, I'm praying for you." Just made my day. So, you know, there's a lot more. We did, at one point I counted among the 36 passengers, we had produced 28 op-eds. I had one in the, of course, Chronicle wouldn't go near it. But I had one in the Oakland Tribune, somebody else did one in the LA Times, Medea did one in the Oakland Tribune also, Medea Benjamin. And everybody worked hard on things like that. So even though the thing was stymied, and then of course the event itself, you know, we had saved 10 places on the boat for media people. And we actually had, you know, major media competing for a place, you know, AP, CBS, New York Times. We had taken some places for Democracy Now! They did a terrific job. But even NPR, which, you know, usually has no time for activists of any species, that they sent their Rome correspondent, Sylvia Poggioli, to interview Hedy Epstein and some other, I think Alice Walker. We had some people who were very attractive to the media. And wrote a really, I mean, I guess wrote is the word, delivered a great story on NPR, you know, and actually one of the few stories about Palestine they've ever heard on NPR where they didn't feel a need to get a quote from the Mark Rega or some other spokesman for the Israelis. So all in all, you know, maybe it's because I'm a media person, but I was thinking of it from the beginning as really a media event. And in that light, I think those of you who contributed to help us get there got your money's worth. I think we, you know, perhaps we didn't get as much media as we would have if we'd been killed, but we got a lot of media, and I think we at least kept the issue, you know, alive, said a little, told people a little bit about Gaza, communicated that actual people who are kind of pretty normal, you know, aren't wearing keffiyehs or whatever, feel very strongly about this and feel like it's a moral and outrage. So I think we accomplished something. Thanks.
Henry can tell the story, because I spent most of the time running around looking for medicines, and at the end of the day, and actually a doctor who very kindly accepted to join us, and she was from Sweden and she was fabulous. But in the meantime, I have to admit I suffer a little bit from flotilla fatigue. I felt as though each time, I think the whole idea, can you hear me? Okay. Each time we wanted to try to expose what's going on in Gaza, and it's so frustrating to be the story of us. And yet, as Henry said, everything is important. Everything is like opening the space, the political space. But I actually was going on these last few trips in hopes of getting back in, because I actually am not a journalist, but I'm working on a documentary from the first trip when we did get in. The problem with getting in the first time is that we were so incredibly celebrated that I never got to do any filming. And I met fabulous people. I just can't wait to go back, because they're the story. And right now, instead of talking about the flotilla itself, I would like to just show, I just put together, if this ever comes off, some clips of a two-hour interview I did with an astrophysicist who was stuck in Gaza for 13 months, not able to get out to go to his appointment in Virginia Tech. Now, some of you might remember this fellow, because he actually, during the Gaza slaughter, he was on Amy Goodman a couple times. His son was killed walking home from school the first day of the bombing. And somehow things were done so that he could bring his family over. And I ended up interviewing him to begin with, because we wanted to take him on the boat. It turns out he couldn't go on the boat, although he had all the legal documents. He had to have visas, etc., because Cyprus wouldn't take anybody coming back. But he called me a month later and said, guess where I am? I got to Virginia. And we kept in touch, and then this awful thing happened to his son. And then 6 months later, he called me again and said, guess where I am? And he said, we're back in Gaza. We want to stand with our people. And right now, he's doing an amazing job. The UN bought him a telescope, and he goes around all of Gaza Strip letting children see the sky. Unfortunately, there was a great story done on him. Only a couple of minor newspapers picked it up. And that's another problem with our media, our mainstream media, our corporate media. Okay, I'm going to begin this right away. It's just Solomon, it's Dr. Baraka, and he's speaking to me in Gaza. I'm trying to gather information to prove that he should be on the boat, that he is an astrophysicist, that he has his visas and everything. But anyway, it's a little bit of his story, and this is just someone that you can't imagine wouldn't be able to get out. I'm going to try it now. Maybe it'll work. I'd like to say the first picture you see is Suleiman with his three children. He now has a new baby, by the way, so to me that's very exciting.
Yeah, how do I get that?
Okay. All right, killed the first day of the bombing.
My name is Suleiman Balakat. I finished my PhD from an Institut d'Astrophysique de Paris 2007 in space physics and astrophysics. I came back home with lots of ideas, and I had a dream to build up the Space Research Center in Gaza. I came last April 2007. And then I started just to build up the first block of building a geomagnetic stations that the government of France will help us build it in Gaza to see how Earth from these coordinates will defend itself from the plasma from the sun. Once the political problems broke up here, I find it very difficult to carry out any serious job in physics or science or anything. So there was no way to leave Gaza, as you know. And the reason always cited as the security. I could not leave Gaza. It does mean that Gaza is closed and it forms the biggest prison in recorded history. 1.5 million stuffed in 300 square kilometers. And if they are punishing Hamas, not everybody is Hamas. And if they are punishing some Palestinian hardliners, as they say, we are not all hardliners. I am a scientist. I was invited to give a talk in Nablus, West Bank, the other part of my country. And I had the honor to lecture beside Professor Alan Cohen, Nobel Prize winner, French scientist. And he said, where is Dr. Baraka? Dr. Baraka was banned to come from Gaza to West Bank for security reasons. He said, how come a scientist that you wanted to cross like for 30 minutes or 40 minutes to come over, he can impose an address about anybody? So I think he wrote a complaint to Israelis and the Foreign Commission and the European Union, and not only those people who have problems or political or military background, but also scientists. A scientist from the States thankfully initiated a sort of help for me, because he's a collaborator with my French supervisor during my PhD. He did try, and he wrote his representative from California, and they contacted the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. After 3 weeks, they say, okay, we are sorry, we cannot allow Palestinians to cross Israel to Amman, but he can leave to Egypt because we don't have control of the border on the other side. As if it is free, you know, it's like a part of Australia or Nevada. Because they control that. They control in fact that, but they just send a signal that it's out of their hand. And then I was advised by some international friends that this is a policy of segregation, isolation of scientists, to limit knowledge and also contacts between Palestinian and Hamas. I am doing solar system physics. The sun and the moon is for everybody. If I work in the search in the universe, it's for everybody. I am a global citizen. I am proud to be a Palestinian. Part of the applications of my work is to protect man and his properties from damaging due to abrupt solar activities. My work is very peaceful and for the betterment of everybody. It's a space weather, and a space if you buy us all, or we if you buy us space. So how come they can ban to cross over, if not to the other side of my country, Spain, to Amman, to do science? Most of those guys who I am associated are Jewish. We have beautiful discussions. We share questions and mathematics together. There is no border. There is no physics for Jewish, physics for Muslims, and physics for Romans. Physics is physics. It's a common language. It's like in music. Huh? It's really. This made me sad. I preserved my work in LPL, Eliana Alibanit Lab in Arizona University, before scientists just to test my results, because I developed new results. Even with my supervisor, I gave three new names, three terminology in astrophysics. and we published this in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Space Physics. I want to do physics. I don't want to, you know, to have a PhD, put it in a file and have some money for that. No. I need to do something. Life is given just once.
You mentioned you were at Penn State.
Yes, I am a Humphrey Fellow. I got the award of Hubert Humphrey Fellowship in 1997. And I finished graduate year, wonderful year. It was in public administration and negotiation. I was exposed to the democracy, election campaigns, how an American can be a president and how an American can be a member of Congress. And we were exposed to issues in social justice and democracy and human rights.
You have a visa to go where?
I have a valid visa to the States, United States, and I have a valid visa to whole Europe. Maybe you find my name in websites of many universities that I was invited there, but I couldn't go there. Even in Japan, I was invited. They gave me $3,000 to go and talk 20 minutes, but I cannot go.
Now, where are you heading to work?
I am going to France to finish a couple of publications with the French scientists, and then I wanted to go to Virginia Tech to pursue my postdoctoral school of program at Virginia Tech.
And who will you be working
with? I will be working with the professor Robert Clower.
Do you have a family?
Yes, I have a family. I have two boys, 13, 11, and 5 years old. I have a lovely daughter, both she. She's 10 years old. Unfortunately, they cannot come with me. This is very hard.
You're saying that in 13 months, you had no way to leave Gaza. There was no border you could cross.
Of course. There are borders on the map. Practically, borders are controlled by Israel. And we are not free to leave. So 14.
I know you know the story, but I just want to share a little bit of this remarkable man who is just one example, obviously, of many, many. And we hope to have him more in our documentary when we ever get back into Gaza. Thank you.
What's his full name again?
His name is Suleiman Baraka. And you can probably Google him.
We are really squeezed with this program, and there have been some technical issues. By the way, I found what I thought I had lost earlier, which is really good news. Anyway, so we'll now move on to hear from Kevin Pina. He is an Oakland native and currently teaches communications at Cal State Hayward. He is an independent journalist and filmmaker and has reported on resistance struggles on the ground in Haiti and Central America. He has been regularly featured on KPFA Flashpoints and provided updates on the Second Freedom Flotilla this past summer. Kevin?
Thank you, Janet. Welcome, everybody, and I too am Troy Davis, as we all are, with horrible news, just one more reflection of the kind of society that we've become, unfortunately. And I guess that's a good opening for, you know, I had some prepared notes, I was going to go academic with this, but I think I'm going to speak from the heart, I'm a little more comfortable. I'm inspired by Henry this evening. In 1980, after having traveled to Central America in the late 70s, I was invited by the FMLN, you guys remember those guys, the Frente Farmona Martí para la Liberación Nacional, to distribute a film for them called El Salvador, El Pueblo Vencerá. And the reason I was invited to distribute this film was because they believed that they needed a bridge. They believed that they needed a North American, or a group of North Americans, who could help to present that film to an audience who heretofore only knew about Central America through a series of white papers that were published by the Reagan administration. You guys remember those infamous white papers about how Cuba and the Soviet Union were invading Central America, that it was just a matter of time before they came over the Rio Grande and started raping our women. Remember that old scenario? The domino theory, right? Well, I took that on, and it was a role, obviously, of advocacy. But it was also a role that I felt was essential and necessary because the people of my country, the people in this country, were only hearing one side of the story. We were hearing that they were godless communists and they were faceless who were trying to impose communism in the Americas, and it was somehow going to end up in our back door and in our backyards and in our beds. Well, to me it didn't seem right that if we were going to call ourselves a democracy, that that implied an informed constituency. And if that implies an informed constituency, that means that I have a duty and a responsibility to present the side of the story that my government and the press are not presenting, because after all, it's our tax dollars. Those wars could not be waged, the CIA could not assassinate priests and nuns. None of that blood would flow, save for the money and our complicity in that whole operation. Whether knowingly, unknowingly, wittingly, unwittingly, we are all part of it. We are all complicit on that level. You know, with local taxes, I don't have to make that argument strongly. We all know that we're complicit on some level, and therefore we have a responsibility. So for me, that was what balance meant. And so when I came into journalism, when I began reporting, I came into it from a perspective of social justice. I didn't know any better. You know, objectivity was not... To me, what wasn't objective was only hearing Reagan's position on El Salvador or Nicaragua. That wasn't objective to me. And it seemed to me that despite a few anomalies in the New York Times, Raymond Bonner in particular, if you remember that, the El Masote massacre, remember when that came out? When he reported on that excellent reporting? But that was an anomaly. Generally speaking, most of the reporting, as it does today, tended to prefer power. Tended to prefer the power of institutions, and the most powerful institution that we know of is the United States government in the world today through its various instruments and levels. I don't have to make that case either, I'm sure, to this audience. So, to me, this question of journalistic objectivity was really a phony argument. That, in fact, when the press talked about balance, and I've got to present a right-winger every time I hear a progressive point of view, was a forced balance. And what it really did was, it, for me, it neutralized the truth. It neutered the truth. There was no there left for me, because the truth lied in, again, social justice. So 1983, of course, was the year where it all became apparent, because you all remember the Vietnam Syndrome, right? Our government could not wage war because of the Vietnam Syndrome, because of the activist role that the press had played, which really wasn't an activist role. It was an investigative role. They did actual reporting during the Vietnam War. We actually saw the bodies of the victims, and they were coming through our pouring through our televisions, oozing through our television screens, and we were, as human beings, aghast and horrified at what was being done in our name. Well, 1983 changed that. 1983 was where the concept of embedded journalism began, right? This was Grenada, the invasion of Grenada, where for the first time in history, the U.S. press agreed to be handled, to be managed, that they would only allow themselves, that they were agreed to rules where they would only allow themselves to report if it was done on the terms of the Pentagon itself. Was no longer done outside of the rules established by the Pentagon in that particular theater of conflict. Well, we know that that ultimately evolved into the modern-day concept of embedding. And we've seen what that has done. It has skewed even further this concept of objectivity that they're teaching down the street at the J School. I have to rail against them, because to me, this is not... They are not admitting to their own bias. They are hiding behind objectivity to continue reporting the story from the position of the major institution of power in the world, which influences them, which is their own government and the Pentagon. And you all know that the Pentagon has its own public relations wing, right? I mean, we all know now that they're also on the internet, right? They're using sock puppets. They're involved. They're watching chat rooms. They're looking for keywords. They're getting in there, and they're chatting, and they're changing the direction of conversations. They are now trying to micromanage information at a level that we have never, ever seen in the history of the world. And the press has been complicit and marched in lockstep with them the entire way, up to the point where we saw this embedded concept carried out in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have also, I would argue, seen it carried out in Libya most recently. I don't know how else to explain when there are 20 journalists from the international corporate media inside of Tripoli, and the majority of stories being read in the press here and seen on television are from journalists embedded with the so-called rebels, while we're not seeing any stories filed from Tripoli, where most of the journalists are in a hotel. I don't know how else to explain that. So, for me, it's a false question if we have to choose between journalism and activism. I don't really understand the question. Because to me, KPFA has been my voice. I have found my voice as a mature member of this community, as a mature member with a family and worried about their future, worried about our future, the future of our planet. And so KPFA has been that voice. Pacifica has been that voice nationally inside of this country. So the real question shouldn't be whether it's a choice between journalism or social justice. The question should be, are we willing to make the commitment to continue supporting the only place, one of the few places in this country where we can still have a voice that allows room for both to live side by side? And I argue again, that is Pacifica and KPFA. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Juggle a whole bunch of things here. Sorry. So Dennis is not going to be able to be with us tonight. Let me move on to talk about Angela Lano's book, Towards Gaza, Live from the Freedom Flotilla. This event is also a book party for this book. Angela and I were boatmates and then cellmates in Israel during last year's flotilla. She wrote the book last summer, a narrative of her experience and also her family's tense period waiting to learn of her condition after the May 31st raid. She published the book in Italian. Then Angela and I collaborated on an English version that we published on lulu.com this past June. If you don't purchase the book here, you can go to lulu.com and you'll find it there. The English version includes a report on a delegation to Brazil by flotilla journalists, various official reports on the 2010 flotilla, many photos, as well as a section in memory of Vittorio Aragoni, an Italian colleague of Angela's, a very special activist who had been a passenger on the first Free Gaza Movement voyage back in 2008 that made it into Gaza. Vic remained and worked in Gaza until he was murdered there last spring. I traveled with Angela this summer to Greece to follow the second flotilla, after which I stayed with her and her family in her medieval house, built in year 1000 in their medieval town in northern Italy. It was a wonderful reunion, but I diverge. Let me read a little from her book. Janet Munya and I are in the same cell. We find it comforting. We are all from the Spendoni and are three different religions and nationalities locked up in one room. The room has two pairs of bunk beds, a small table and chair, a wardrobe, and a tiny toilet, and two surveillance cameras pointed at us, one in the toilet. There is a TV holder on the wall like a hospital room, but no TV. The entire building is new. It was built for you, the prison guards say ironically. We're clearly the first prisoners to enter. There is dusty debris on the floor in our cell that was not cleaned away from the new construction before we inhabited the space. They call us back to the common room and have us sit at some tables. We're interviewed by a doctor and a social worker. I don't remember that, by the way. We give only our names and nationalities and insist on presence of lawyers and ambassadors. They reply that we have no rights since we entered Israel illegally. We respond that we were kidnapped while bringing humanitarian aid to Gaza, and that we have had no intention of entering Israel. I say loudly, you are violating our rights and my freedom of press. You've violated international law. I continue chanting until they send me to the prison director. I repeat the same phrases to him, and he asks me, do you want to go home? Of course, I respond, just like everyone else. We're not interested in staying in Israel. It's you who have kidnapped us in international waters and brought us here. Our intention was to go to Gaza. I'm a journalist following the Freedom Flotilla. I've been arrested and prevented from doing my job. You have seized my writing pad, pens, video camera, and photo camera. You're a journalist? Prove it. Do you have a press card? It's in my bag, which I was forced to leave on the ship, along with my money, credit card, and cell phone, and all the rest of my personal belongings. So you can't prove it? Then he asked what paper I work for. I respond vaguely in order to not give him too much information, which I assume they must already have in reality. He asked me to sign the same document, the admission of responsibility for illegal entry in Israeli waters. I refuse, stressing that this situation is their fault, not mine. He sends me away and calls my companions. Nobody signs. Angela and I have donated copies of her book, which is on sale over there, as I said, and the proceeds go to KPFA. So I think we're ready for the documentary, and so this is a film made by Marcello Faraggi, who is an independent Belgian journalist and filmmaker. And we met when he was on the same boat for several days. He then moved to a different boat. Some of the famous photos and video clips of the Mavi Marmara were ones he took that he was not credited for. The film also includes the last footage of Vittorio Aragone that he was able to arrange before he lost ship. Try to Skype in Marcello. This is a preview of his film, so it's not for public consumption yet. We're going to try to have a Kickstarter project going. So maybe that's something that you'll be able to support. He'll talk about it a little bit. All right, let me see.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, to hear you. Good evening.
Welcome, Marcello. So I'm going to turn the laptop around, the camera, and you can see who's here, and you can go ahead, and we just saw the film.
Hello, everybody. Good evening. So I can't see you, but I can hear you. Thank you for watching the film. Thank you for your interest.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think it was clear, I suppose, for everybody that this was a very extraordinary experience and not easy. And one of the problems maybe occurred because of the no thing between journalists and activists or passengers. From the beginning, that the organizers did not really precisely indicate who is an activist and who is a journalist. So even for officials, or let's say police, military, and associations from journalists too, it was not easy in the first days to say, okay, they are journalists too, and we have to respect the freedom of press. So I would say the next time it would be easier for everybody, for all sides, if it's really clear what is your role, what is my role, and then to proceed. But maybe first I should answer some questions occurred among you, please.
So Marcello, can you hear?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to have a Q&A, a question and answer later. Can you wait for that, or do you want to be asked specifically now?
I'm sorry, can I wait?
Do you want to, we're going to have the panel of the other speakers with Q&A, but this, we were going to... I was wondering whether do you want to wait until then, or do you for questions and answers, or did you want to say some more, maybe about Kickstarter possibilities and your challenges with the film?
Could you hear me already at the beginning, or?
Yeah.
Okay. So yes, if I may, so just indicate that. With the help of some donors, I could produce this film. And thanks to Janet, we are looking now whether we can show it to a broader audience, because maybe most of you who stream media are not really open for such kind of information. And I'm very curious to hear about your opinion, whether you think this film merits to be seen by other people too, because, you know, when you are so close involved as me in this project, I cannot judge really. So I'm really curious to hear about your opinion. And one way could be to see whether we can put this project on the platform Kickstarter. You heard maybe about it, to see whether we can get some further fundings, and then to distribute it for free on DVD to universities, schools, and even to make it available to television channels. Mm-hmm. So maybe I can stop here, and please, I'm glad to answer your questions.
Right, and so maybe there are people here who have who are connected with nonprofits, and it would be great if a nonprofit could sponsor this project. So let me know if you have any connections to that and might be interested in sponsoring this project. It's ready to go, it's just we need a nonprofit to work. So, I'm going to, why don't we have questions and answers and maybe specifically about the film, and then later we'll have the rest of the panelists. Right. So, So, Marcello, sorry, the camera isn't working on this end, so you won't be able to see people.
Well, I'm sorry that I'm not with you. Next time.
Yes, next time.
All right, we're passing a mic around.
Thank you, Marcello.
Can you hear?
Very much. And this, of course, is 2 days in the States where things are coming to a head now. The only window of hope that I read in one paper is that if Obama or U.S. would just abstain instead of say no to the Palestinian request. Do you think that there's any possibility of combining instead of separating an activist and a journalist? It seems that the journalists, for the most part, on this flotilla are activists. And so I don't understand why the division.
Thank you for your question. I must say, because of my background, that I could have been activist for many hundreds of purposes because I reported about it. And this makes clear it's impossible to become, as a journalist, always an activist for this cause and this cause and that cause and this cause. And furthermore, you're talking directly about politics. And I'm not doing politics. Even if I can say sometimes it occurred because I reported on certain stories as an investigative journalist, on the political side, it happened something. People had to retire or it happened a scandal. But it was never me. I just delivered a message and I tried to explain what happened for an ordinary citizen. And I think this makes times more credible because I'm not trying to manipulate, and I hope so you believe me, maybe you don't believe me, but I try at least not to manipulate opinion.
My name is Rick Sterling, and I thought the video was excellent. Very entertaining, very professionally done. I think it would be very interesting for TV audiences who don't know anything about it. It's so well done. And I look forward to seeing its distribution here in North America. Have you started the distribution in Europe yet? And what's been the response there so far?
Thank you for your question. You have to join our team. Please come with us and see what we can do to distribute the film. There are two sorts of processes. May I start with Germany? Television stations in Germany, even before I've seen the film and before knowing what will be the budget, they said, oh, no, sorry, we have no time slot and we have no money in the next few years, so we will not put it on air. So there you understand that there's already a political problem with this television channels. From other countries, they mostly said, well, didn't you present us the film the day after the assault? Well, I'm sorry, I wasn't visiting. And have to find people who are really, really deeply interested in, and not just in entertainment or just showing blood, but to deal more seriously with this topic. And any idea, any comment, we'd suggest. Thank you again for your compliments.
Hello, my name is Donna Carter, and I work with a large group of people who are not aware of Palestine and what's going on there, and where this audience is, and certainly you're deeply involved in. But I think for a larger audience, although I did enjoy the film a great deal, it would help to have a brief explanation about why the ships are going there. And just, you know, you don't want to overwhelm it with the historical thing, but just a little bit more basic explanation there.
So if I understood, this is your suggestion maybe to modify or to include more basic information. Yeah, it's true that you are always fighting whether you will take time to give basic information or whether you and explain more. I think you're right, and it can be used. This is the idea of people, and I think it's a good idea, just to initiate a discussion and then to go further, you know, and not say, okay, we will do a complete film and nobody has anything to say anymore about it. No, let's take it as a kickoff, okay?
How were you able to get this film through the Israeli process? And you have no film about the attack on your boat.
Well, maybe your last question there for the moment. I do have some more still pictures on it. The video footage from my boat seems to be so excellent that the military decided to keep them, unfortunately. And how to get this film through the public in Israel, I understood your question.
Through the military.
Yes, well, I think what we need now, if it starts, you know, sometimes you need a first step and then others will follow. So we have to overcome the first burden, and then I think the film will be shown around. And I'm very optimistic, and just if we can finance the first outcome, and we have all the rights and everything is played, etc., which is not a huge sum, maybe John can tell you a bit more about it, are able to be more actively on this television market and video market, etc.
Hi. One thing I wanted to say, I just thought the tension, the way it was built up was great, and the music was super great. The visual was beautiful, and I liked what you said about not trying to manipulate people with it. I thought just artistically it was really, really, really enjoyable. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you for your comments. Thank you very much.
So
we'll tell the questions too.
We'll have two more questions.
Marcello, this is Jean St. Ange. I don't know if you remember me. I was on the Spandoni with you. How are you?
Nice to hear you again.
Nice,
hello.
It's nice to see you again. So, how's Mario, by the way? Anyways.
Yes?
So a question I have is, are you aware that one of our fellow passengers on the Spandoni, a fellow named Almadi Al-Harati, has an interesting story himself. Turns out he's one of the rebel commanders of the Libyan forces that just, in fact, he led the brigade that took over Tripoli, apparently. So he's a big hero in Dublin right now, and as well as Libya. So I don't know if you knew about this and whether this may be a story you want to pursue.
No, I'm unfortunately not. I'm not aware about it, but please, let's keep in touch. And I have to learn more about it. Okay?
I still have your email address, so I'll send you something.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Sure.
Take care.
Should I stand up? I guess.
Yes, my name is Mary Berger. I don't know if that's relevant, but I really want to thank you for this film. It was immensely powerful and moving, and even you say it's a rough cut and it's not finished, but the flow, the rhythm, in every way, it seems pretty well finished to me, and much better conceived and accused and executed than many so-called finished films, I feel. You have for example, the little touch of the bird, this beautiful bird, and there's all this, these things, it's just so powerful. And I really think it needs to be sown on TV, perhaps more than movies, than movie houses, because it needs to reach the maximum number of people. It is totally impartial. You portray the people, the diversity of the number of people. They're ordinary people. Some are specialists. Some are nobody at all. They just came for the ride and everything in between. And you convey this with a very little means to convey this. So I'm really impressed with this film, and I really hope we can. I don't know what we have to, unfortunately don't know how to do donations, and I don't have any connections. I wish I did, because I want to get it to a wider audience, which is TV. Better than, it's good in schools, but and that's good too, but schools and TV, but, so that the average Joe Dokes could get a chance to see this. I think everyone who did would be changed. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Finances of the film. The film is done, but there's outstanding bills. Less than, let's say, $10,000, something like that. So if that could be raised, then it could go public. But again, we could use a nonprofit or an individual if they would be willing to sponsor this and get in touch with me. Please.
Yes.
All right. So you missed the applause for the after the film, but we just had that for you now. And
thank you. Thank you very, very much. Beautiful discussion and nice evening still. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'd like us to spend a little time talking about KPFA, and then we'll have the rest of the speakers come and answer questions. And KPFA, this is a benefit for KPFA. We have the interim general manager, Andrew Phillips, here. We have a number of the LSB members and some staff, some programmers. So, do you want to say a word or two?
Good evening, everybody. It's just great to be here. And just amongst the powerful advocates, all the mic close. Just amongst a bunch of powerful activists. And, I don't know how to say this, but I'd like to make a more benefit for the filmmaker of the KPFA. We're always asking for money. Without the work that these filmmakers do, this is a part of our job too. So, with due respects, you know, we're not going to make a fortune here tonight, but it could be really helpful for our filmmakers. So I'd like to say that. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Janet, for your great work.
Another thing, I don't know how many of you are not members of KPFA, but there's a table back there, and you can become a member. One of the things about the fellowship here, there's always an action, and maybe one of your actions would be to become a member if you aren't already. So we can take a small break and then have the rest of the panelists come. Let's take a 5-minute break. Really? And stretch your legs. Sorry? All right, should we just go to a Q&A?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, why don't we do that? So, Henry and Dennis has arrived. And he can join us. And Kevin.
We could bring some chairs up, or...
Well, sorry I missed most of the program, everybody. I was, I have to admit it, I was sleeping.
Really? What an unusual thing to do.
We, you know, did all that we could around Troy Davis and the state-sponsored murder, and, you know, certain things just give way to other things. I don't want to do a pitch for money, but I want to tell you just a very brief story about the power of Pacifica in the context of fighting for Palestine. And it goes like this. I'm at the Motor Vehicle Bureau in New York. This is before computers, where the lines took about 15 hours. And if you didn't have the right papers, you went to the back of the line again. I don't know if you've ever been through this now. I'm sure they had it out on the West Coast too. Anyway, I was waiting on the line, and there was a young woman and her mother there in front of me. And the young woman just starts turns around and starts talking to me and says, you know, what do you do? I said, well, I do radio, and I like to, you know, give people a chance to go on the radio and tell stories. And she said, really? I think my mother would have a story that you'd really love to get on the radio. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, here, let me introduce you to my mother. Well, the story was, and I did bring her on KPFA, and it's sort of one of my first Palestine stories. I mean, I brought her on WBAI in New York, forgive me. So, it turns out that this was a woman who was in Hitler Youth, young in Hitler Youth, had a lot of intellectual hate about Jews, but didn't see the camps. And she was one of those who was gathered. This happened many times, where the U.S. forces would come in and bring the children, the German children, to the front. As they would open the gates, they would have a lot of people watch to make sure, particularly the kids, knew what their parents were up to at these camps. So this member of Hitler Youth had this experience, moved to the United States, worked her whole life, and she vowed that she would try and repay her debt to the Jews. So after she retired, she moved to Israel and actually was working on a kibbutzim with Holocaust survivors. And she heard them, and she was really enjoying them. Then they started to talk about Palestinians the way she heard her parents talking about Jews. So, and she began to meet Palestinians. So ultimately, what happened was, she decided, you know, my life, my commitment is to stopping this kind of oppression. Now here I am with the Jews doing it to the Palestinians. I think I'm going to go work for Palestinian freedom. So this former member of Hitler Youth,
wow,
goes through the kibbutzim with the Holocaust survivors and ends up being an advocate for Palestinian rights. And where else in the world could you hear a story where somebody be given a platform? And believe me, I'm shortening it. This was an extraordinary story. But who would ever give this kind of story a platform? It would be rare. She was never going to share this story until we met at the Motor Vehicle Bureau. And here was Pacifica. And believe me, it was a very moving story that she told on the air. And that, for me, is at the core of what Pacifica and KPFA and WBAI can offer, a special platform for people who would never have a voice for a story that we all need to be able to hear and learn from. So that's the kind of thing I think about when I think about defending KPFA and Pacifica and making sure that we can sustain it. And it is a struggle now. So again, what I want all of you to do is to make sure The fundraiser's coming up, and no matter what you think about any side or any angle, the fundraiser is coming up, and everybody in here needs to convince 10 of their friends or relatives. Really, make a commitment in this spot when the fundraiser starts. Each of you have to get 10 people to subscribe to the station. That would be an incredible contribution. That's all I'm going to say. That's my pitch. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
So now we're open for questions for everyone.
Something special happened on KPFA this morning. Were any of you listening when Dolores Huerta was on the KPFA? Nobody here? Because I'm in Nolan Bryant. I came on there and questioned an old friend of Dolores Huerta's, and I pointed out we've got a bill starting now for the 20 million jobs in this country, rebuilding the forests, and that's in that we're getting processed. And Dolores Huerta is on the board of directors, and she was very complimentary at what we're doing. I just wonder if anybody here picked that up, because I was the one on KPFA talking with Dolores.
Was she on the morning mix?
Yes. Well, I don't know exactly where, but she was by herself there being interviewed.
I would like to say a word on KPFA. I don't think the value is truly appreciated. If we are to have a democracy, we need to have a free press. If you are going to vote, you have to know what the choices are, other than the election is not worth anything. And there are not many outlets like KPFA, and so I hope the listeners, the staff, and everyone involved in it will truly appreciate that and eventually be able to share it with others. Thank you.
I just wonder if one of you could enlighten me as to why, in Berkeley in particular, and the East Bay, there is such a mighty small contingent that has such power, can pretty much shut down the Daily Planet, can get the UC Berkeley to keep divesting in Israel, even though there was a massive movement, can shut down the exhibit at MoCA. Ad infinitum. Are there other cities that are under such a grip besides Berkeley? And
yeah, everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, look, this exhibit has traveled many cities without disruption. The Oakland Tribune did a fine bit of publicity for it. Pictures, full front page.
I'll speak to that, I guess. You know, I think the... it's a taboo subject, but we have to face the fact that the Jewish community, parts of it, has a tremendous amount of, well, all of it as a group has a tremendous amount of economic, political, and cultural power in this society at this point in history. And the institutional leadership of that community, not all the individuals in it, but the institutional leadership of it, is absolutely committed to defending Israel no matter what it does, and to squelching anybody who makes any serious effort to be critical of it. If you haven't read Walton Mearsheimer's book called The Israel Lobby, I recommend that highly. It's only the beginning, though. You know, it doesn't even get into this kind of thing, the local level, the control and the suppression of information and discussion.
Like Rabbi Lerner's house, for instance?
You know, for instance, but, you know, the Smoka thing is a classic. And we know, you know, we know how it works. They don't make a secret of it. You know, some, I forget the name of the National Jewish Organization that announced last year they were devoting $6 million to combat what they call the delegitimization of Israel. They're distributing it to all these local groups like the Jewish Community Relations Council and the Jewish Federation, which have headquarters East Bay Branch. As headquarters in Oakland, and they've openly boasted that they've openly taken credit for forcing the Museum of Children's Art to close that. You know, it's not clear whether the board of the museum capitulated directly to their pressure, or what I suspect is more likely is that they probably went to some of the funders. You know, if you look at the philanthropic community in the Bay Area in particular, it's heavily Jewish. It's not entirely, but the Haas and the Goldman and the Oshers and so on. A lot of the major local foundations are Jewish, and I don't know if they're all Zionists, but they all, it's a little like what I was saying before about the media. You know, there are people who are Zionists, but there are a lot more people who are afraid to stand up to them. So if the zealots or frankly the paid operatives, you know, people make a good living going around taking up things like this and going to the funders and cajoling and if necessary threatening them and getting them to talk to the MoCA people who are of course like every other and MoCA, you know, we should say is a very progressive organization, does wonderful work in many ways. And of course, they're strapped for money, so they are vulnerable. And people often talk about the Jewish money in politics, and that is a major factor. But it really goes way beyond that. I think it has to do with the cultural element, the place that the Jews, American Jews, have attained an extraordinary position in the media, in the universities, in the think tanks, the Beltway policy pundit culture. That really shapes the whole climate of opinion in this country. And, I don't know what to do about it except to say that people, both Jews certainly need to stand up to it. But non-Jews do too, and non-Jews have to get over all of us have to get over the fear of being accused of anti-Semitism, and we have to, learn to stand up to those people and call them what they are, which is bullies and bigots, and convince other Americans, without falling into, anti-Jewish, whatever, bias on our own part, we have to be honest and convince other Americans that these people are pursuing the interests of another country, that they're violating law and morality and everything else, and we have to stop, the guilt about persecution in Europe and guilt about the Holocaust and all the rest is no excuse for what's going on now, and people need to stand up to it. So, sorry, I went on some more.
Question for Henry and for Dennis. As journalists, it was mentioned a number of times today, there were 60 journalists on the first flotilla, there were 10 or something spaces reserved on your ship on the second flotilla. It seemed that were times where many people get a camera, they're activists, they go there, they cover, part of their activism is to cover what they're doing, and they're citizen journalists. And they go with something, get arrested, get mistreated. You have the Committee to Protect the Journalists coming there and saying sometimes, well, you can't do that, you have to treat them differently, have special protection as journalists. Now, there's a good and a bad thing there. One thing is more protection to people who are trying to expose truth to the world. And the bad thing is when you try to broaden that protection to a larger number of pool people, then government and law enforcement are more likely to say, you know what, screw that. Everybody's pretending to be a journalist, not journalists, so they would mistreat both the citizen journalists as well as the professional journalists, as well as everybody else who claims to be a journalist. So the umbrella of protection becomes thinner. And that endangers our ability to get some news, because they may just be prevented. It degrades the currency, in other words. So my question is, as yourself having been on both sides of the aisle, that is mostly in one of them, when you're out there doing your job as a professional journalist, how do you feel about the prospect that others who are not really doing that, who are like me with a camera, blogging at one device, can claim the same kind of special protection that you're entitled to, and by doing that, maybe lessen the kind of protection that you're entitled to? Would you yourself, if you're going out as an activist, like you're going to this last patrol, claim or pretend to claim a special treatment or a special kind of protection as a journalist, even though not really commissioned there? And don't try to read too much into my own opinion. I'm doing some kind of developments here. But I'd like to read both your opinions on that. Thank you.
You go first.
Thank you.
I think that's a very astute analysis of some of the dynamics that we've seen in recent decades about what's happening with journalism. I guess I would say that even when I was a professional journalist, I was always a little uncomfortable with this special status. You know, I think everybody's entitled to rights, you know. There is the constitutional right that does, you know, does give some rights. But, you know, a funny thing, without getting into too much about my story, but after I got fired, I had a lot of consultations with lawyers and so on, and the ACLU and other people, and basically they were very sympathetic, but it was a very interesting case. It was relevant to mine. It happened in Tacoma when another paper up there fired and demoted a journalist, actually, because of her politics, and she sued them and so on. And the ruling went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, actually. In the end, the newspaper claimed that the First Amendment protected their right to fire her or to demote her in that case. The First Amendment works both ways. I guess I think that the trend towards citizen journalism on the whole is all to the good. You know, that more people have cameras, more people are reporting. Yes, they don't necessarily have training. They may be a little rough around the edges, and they may be more openly biased. But, you know, I think that it's worth the trade-off. We're getting more variety of information. You know, we all experience it on the internet every day, I think. To the extent that it weakens, as you suggested, the protections that journalists used to have, so be it. We need to fight for the rights of all the journalists. We need to fight for the truth. That's the main thing, wherever it comes from, whether it comes from someone with a professional certification or without.
Henry, I'm having a forgetting moment here. The great journalist who reports from Ramallah. Fajarowitz.
Amirahas,
thank you. Amirahas writes for mainstream Israeli newspapers. She reports the truth. Robert Fisk often quotes Amirahas as saying that the core responsibility is to monitor the centers of power. Wherever we are, and to report to the people, whether it's the government, the military, the whatever, that's the job. But in modern times, the journalists have become part of the centers of power and like to be embedded, whether it's formally with the military or informally, you know, being insiders, being able to expect to get that call that heads up from the White House that gives them 3 hours over everybody else. And you learn, as a journalist, if you want that access, you shut your mouth about the issues that you're not supposed to talk about, or you don't get the access, you're not considered a journalist. But there's another level, and Robert Fisk wrote about this. What happens to journalists, particularly Jewish journalists, who tell the truth about Israel? Now, I can tell you that I've had dozens of emails. You know, one goes something like, birth scene, you know, God bless you, and God willing, if all goes well, you'll have your throat slit Daniel Pearl style.
Yeah.
I've gotten emails from young rabbinical students in Israel saying, you're old, you're garbage, you're going to die, you know, you hate yourself. I mean, it's unbelievable the kinds of things that happen. And I'm going to be very honest with you. In terms of the last management, the last two managements, I personally was called aside. I was asked, couldn't I cool it? There were visits. Do you remember who visited Roy Campanella?
Yeah.
You know, major Jewish organizations came to question him. And he called me in to say, well, you know, do they have a point? You know, I'm being questioned by, I've been told to cool it during fundraisers by various managers within Pacifica. And I am absolutely sure that I am repeatedly excluded from national programming, in part because people are going to be afraid what I'm going to say about Israel and about the real politic of what's going on behind the scenes. It is frightening sometimes. I've given lectures where there are 15 members of, you know, whatever you want to call them, Jewish defenders of Israel, where literally I've spoken at events where there are 10 of these thugs, and they've got like a little gauntlet going into the room, and they've got leaflets, so you know, you have to go through the gauntlet, and they're shoving leaflets, and let me tell you, it scares people away.
You didn't get the pepper spray?
It's very aggressive at all levels, and they have an impact at all levels. And you know, if you're in the mainstream and you want to get your story on the cover, don't do it about Israel, and don't dare mention occupation. You don't do it, or you lose your career. It is real, and everybody knows that they're going to shut their mouth. It's an epidemic of self-censorship when it comes to Israel, because if people really want a career and they want to go up the journalistic ladder, shut their freaking mouth about Israel.
I just want to add, you know, I've used my press credentials to save people from being shot where police would not fire. I used my KPFA Flashpoints credentials to put a camera and point it at police officers who were about to shoot unarmed demonstrators. And is that crossing the line from journalism to activism? I kind of don't care.
So it's kind of, we've reached 10 o'clock, and unfortunately, we probably should wrap it up.
Can I say something?
Okay.
I just want to say something about Kathy. Yeah. Kathy's shy and has, you know, used her time to show the interview there. But, you know, Kathy's been on how many of these boats?
Just three.
Just three, okay.
Oh, wow.
Just three.
And,
last one to four. Steve says four. All right. On this last flotilla, you know, it's actually, maybe you got a little bit of a sense from the movie, but even that didn't go into the logistics of putting together an operation like this are enormous. You know, fundraising, you know, he said they had 6 weeks of water, you know. Somebody had to go buy that, arrange it, the food, the guy with the knife who's cutting the vegetables. You know, just so much work goes into all these things. And Kathy was, you know, specifically on the medical area, medical preparations, but in general on the whole logistical team. So even though she's quiet, I want to just give credit to her for a tremendously important role in this whole operation.
Thank you, all of you.
Mike Davis has been on KPFA.
I've interviewed him at least three times.
Did you ever talk about Buddha's wife? Is Buddha's wife? Because in that,
so.
I'm just saying the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. Just like Martin Luther King said, that the U.S. is the greatest purveyor of violence. Well, the founding of Israel was through terrorism. They're the ones who invented the bombing of cafes and buses and so on back in the 20s and 30s of the Israelis.
Thank you, Steve. And why don't we take this offline and maybe we can spend a little time after. Would people also help move the chairs back? And thank you all for coming. Join KPFA.